Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
Lights out, and away we ayo. Welcome to No Breaks, a Formula One podcast from the No Dunks Inc. Classic Factory, proudly a part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Whether you're joining us live in the Slipstream team here on YouTube or listening to the podcast later, thank you very much. I'm your host, Trey Kirby, and I'm joined today by our local F1 expert and a man who took a 90-minute nap yesterday, Graydon Gordian.
It was lovely.
Yeah, get a nice really sleep nice. In.
Yeah, you know, this isn't my only gig. I do something else on the side as well as just do
tuning F1 cars,
a weekly
of course, yes.
F1 podcast. To support my family, and I do have the week off of work, so I got a little nap in.
It was little napski.
Yeah. Good you know, stuff. I'm your sleepy guy. I'm a sleepy guy sometimes. So.
Still taking naps. That's impressive, man.
I love naps.
You haven't had your kids for long enough. Eventually, you'll just, every time you close your eyes, you'll think you're hearing them crying, even if they're not crying. You won't be able to take a nap. It'll completely ruin it for you. So something to look forward to.
Okay.
There's our fist pound of the day here on No Breaks. We've also got our team principal.
I don't want a fist pound to my inability to take naps, though. I don't want to celebrate that.
Our team principal on the pit wall making the right calls. JD, am I telling the truth here about future nap?
Yeah, yes, you
skills?
Are. You are, but it actually comes back because your kids are... You know, they're sort of at the age where they still need you.
Yep.
You know, mine, yeah, they'd want nothing to do with me. So the naps are coming back.
Okay. I like that.
Are you,
yeah,
are
something
you,
to look forward
okay,
to.
Okay. If you're napping, are you thinking, are you like TV napper? Like, let me put on golf and just pass out? Mm-hmm. Or are you getting in bed? What's your nap strategy here?
I do both. Okay. I do both.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
baseball game, napper. Throw on the Braves game, throw on the Jays game. That's a great nap,
yeah. But sometimes... Baseball's good for napping, yeah.
Yeah, sometimes I'll just get undressed and under the covers and, like, as if I'm going to bed.
That's what I did yesterday. I did, like, a full nap, like a hard nap.
Yeah.
Not a couch nap. I did a bed, a hard, derobed bed nap.
This man did a hard, derobed bed nap yesterday. 90 minutes. No robe. Just napping. Great stuff. JD, I listened to No Bunts this morning.
Yeah, yes.
Some banging, some saws. But it's sounding great right here, right
it
now.
It's sounding good right now. We got to keep this within their lunch break.
Okay.
Yeah, let's get speedy.
All right, what do we got? 49 minutes then to speed run the Monza GP. Let's talk about quali. That was a weird one, Graydon. What stuck out to you about qualifying? We watched it, and then despite everybody driving out there, nobody knew what was going on for the actual starting grid on Sunday.
Yeah, that actually was insane how long it took them to determine what the actual starting grid would be. It was hours after the conclusion of qualifying that the FIA finally released the provisional starting grid. I really don't have a good explanation for why that is. You'd think it'd be very clear-cut that they would understand how the penalties are applied and you could calculate that. Pierre Gasly, like, tweeting out, I think, something like, could somebody please tell me where I'm starting tomorrow? I enjoyed it. But, I mean, quali was interesting. I actually thought that quali made me excited for race day, seeing the Ferrari's pace compared to the Red Bulls. You got the impression that maybe they could compete, although Red Bull had always been saying that their high downforce setup was probably more about long runs, more optimized for race day than it was for qualifying. So it looks like Ferrari probably may have, you know, over-indexed on single lap speed as opposed to long run speed, but you know, it was good. I mean, big shout out to Nyck de Vries, who didn't started in the top 10, but didn't actually get there, I believe, in qualifying. But he did. It was only after all the penalties, but he did make it out of Q1.
Yeah,
I believe, which was impressive. Yeah, not easy to do in your first ever F1 qualifying. That was awesome to see. And you know, and another successful Saturday for Charles Leclerc, the new Mr. Saturday.
Is he becoming the new Mr. Saturday?
I know we call George Russell Mr. Saturday, but Charles' day really is Saturday. That's his best day of the weekend.
Yeah,
and by
said,
a wide margin.
Ferrari may have over-indexed for one lap speed rather than race speed. I honestly think kind of a good call. As we saw during the race on Sunday, it did not matter what Ferrari was doing. But they dominated on Saturday, which was a pretty cool moment for Ferrari fans. I think Sainz won Q2, if I'm not mistaken. But knowing he was going to be taking a back of the grid penalty, he was kind of out there more to tow Leclerc along in Q3. Leclerc puts it on pole, his final lap of Q3, and the Tifosi were going crazy. That was actually really cool to see. So
yeah.
Maybe they bought, or maybe Sunday, they didn't have the car to actually challenge Verstappen, but they dominated Saturday, so and at least they got one of the 2 days.
For sure, and it was really fun to see him take pole and in front of the fans. And in general, that is probably the best part about the Monza GP. I mean, there's lots of fun things about the track, but the fans, it's the, you know, obviously just coming off the Dutch Grand Prix where the fans are also out of control, you know, that's really fun and exciting. But Monza is the league leader in terms of like fan intensity and noise and enthusiasm. Nobody is quite like the Italian fans. And they're awesome.
I thought it was also cool. Very cool that Leclerc ended up winning pole since he was like the one guy we knew that if he wins pole, he's staying there no matter what because the penalties were crazy. Max Verstappen, Esteban Ocon had 5-place penalties. Sergio Perez had a 10-place penalty. Mick Schumacher, Valtteri Bottas, and Kevin Magnussen had 15-place penalties. I didn't even know that was a thing. And then Carlos Sainz, Lewis Hamilton, and Yuki Tsunoda took back-of-the-grid penalties. The only thing worse than a 15-place penalty is a back-of-the-grid penalty. So
this is a lot of penalties.
It was a ton of penalties. The results were crazy. Like, by car driving, the results from Q3 were Leclerc, Verstappen, Sainz, Perez, Hamilton, Russell. By the time we actually started on Sunday, it was Leclerc, Russell, Norris, Ricciardo, Gasly, Alonso. Just all over the place. People are like, when do you apply the 5-place penalty compared to the 15-place penalty? Are they doing it in order? It was tough to figure out, but eventually they got the cars started on Sunday. They raced an almost entire race. So let's take a look at the top 10 in Monza. It's highlighted by Max Verstappen winning once again. Another dominant win for Max. He finished P1, followed by Leclerc in P2, despite many strategy changes from Ferrari. George Russell finished in P3 because this guy is Mr. Steady at this point. Carlos Sainz drove back from P18, finished P4. Lewis Hamilton started P19, finished P5. Then he's followed by Perez in 6th, Norris, Gasly, Nick DeVries in the Williams. Ooh. Finishing in 9th, getting a few points there. And Zhou Guan Yu picked up some points as well for Alfa Romeo, coming in 10th there. I don't know where you want to start here, Graydon. I guess we should talk about Max Verstappen literally dominating this race. That's the 11th win of the season for him, the most in his career. He ended up starting P7 because he just got a nice, solid 5-place grid penalty. But he was in P4 at the end of lap 1, P3 at the end of lap 2. He passed into 2nd place in lap 5, and then he finally took over the lead in lap 13 when Leclerc pit during a virtual safety car.
Right.
It was crazy to watch how fast Verstappen had made up the gap. I mean, 7th to 1st, not a huge gap compared to what Verstappen's been doing
recently.
But this was like, it felt like he was winning the race by the end of the first lap, even though he started 7th.
Yeah, I definitely think looking at it, you know, when he got up into 3rd, when he got into a podium place so quickly, but also when he, you know, got up into 2nd, overtook Russell, it definitely, the writing was on the wall right there. It was like, we'll come to Ferrari strategy choices in a moment, but it definitely felt like at this point in time, it's like, okay, straight up, head-to-head, both Leclerc and Verstappen running similar strategies, this isn't going to be competitive at all. And I think that part of it is just Verstappen is firing on all cylinders right now. He's driving with so much confidence and, you know, he's crushing it. Part of it is the Red Bull car has at this point meaningfully surpassed the Ferrari car. They used to be very neck and neck. There were weekends where the Ferrari was genuinely faster. That is not the case anymore, and it has not been the case across a variety of tracks now.
Oh, yeah.
We've seen them in very different contexts, tracks that kind of would emphasize different parts of the car, and the Red Bull is dominant nonetheless. That is a pretty definitive statement about the quality of the two cars at this time. You know, so in this point, it's really not clear what Ferrari can throw at them in order to eke out wins here. He's a very deserving world champion. This was a dominant win. This has been a dominant stretch here. You know, it is Schumacher-esque. It's peak Hamilton-esque. It's a really serious season, right up there with the stuff you saw from the McLarens in the mid-80s and folks like that, right? I mean, this is a really dominant championship and a really dominant Italian Grand Prix from him.
Yeah, they're crushing it. Great quote from Verstappen afterwards. He said, "We don't need to win anymore, but we want to." And it's actually true. Like, he could finish P2 in all of the races here on out and still take home the championship. It's only a matter of time, but Red Bull's looking good. They ended up winning with Verstappen by about 2.5 seconds over Leclerc. However, we were kind of robbed of a little bit of an ending here as the race ended underneath the yellow flags, Graydon. Daniel Ricciardo spun out a few laps before the race, maybe like 8 laps prior. Where his car was, despite the track being clear, they couldn't get to it quick enough with the cherry picker. I thought that was hilarious. They kept calling it a cherry picker, which it
is. Yeah, I guess it was locked in gear or something.
They couldn't
They couldn't move it, so you needed something that could snatch it and carry it away. This to me is simple, and you saw it almost universally from the drivers, everybody from Verstappen to Leclerc to Hamilton to folks up and down the grid, wishing they had ended racing, wishing they had ended under greens, and being and calling for them to have changed how this mentioned. A lot of people mentioning, Christian Horner mentioning, we should have just red flagged the race. Hamilton suggesting they should extend the race in these contexts. That's interesting. It's a little, they do that in other series. It's a little bit complicated because of the fuel, the regs around the fuel and how much fuel they're carrying and how much fuel you have to end with. You'd have to amend those regulations in some way to account for an extension of the race. But I think this is like an eminently solvable problem. It's like first of all, they should have thrown the safety car much faster. They actually, like his car stops, and then they take a moment to throw the safety car, and that costs laps that could have been part of the restart. Mm-hmm. But even more than that, I just think it's like, if there's a safety car with less than 5 laps left, just red flag the race. Just like have it be standards. Like, we're going to red flag the race. We're going to stop. We're going to do a standing restart or do a rolling restart if you think that's unfair to the to the person who's in the lead. I imagine they'd do a standing restart in dry conditions, though. And then, like, just let them finish. That's what everybody wants. They're making so many choices right now that are entertainment-focused. This is an obvious pro-entertainment win on their part, to end races under green flags. So
I agree with you. They should have tossed the red flag immediately just to shut down the race so that they could have a restart and have a few laps left of racing. I guess part of the concerns with that is, like you're saying, number one, the fuel, maybe not having enough fuel left over because the teams try to have the exact perfect amount of fuel. If the race is getting extended, perhaps they have problems there. Understandable. There's ways to work around that. The other concern I had seen people have is that if they red flag, that's like a guaranteed 15 minutes stop to the race, right? Where they gotta get everybody off the track, they got to go back to the pits, everybody does their updates while they're waiting, get everybody out there. Guess what else takes a long time? Driving around in circles during a yellow flag for no reason. At least after this shutdown, you get a race at the end of it, so something will change.
You could even have those rules, though, and the time it takes to do a red flag, it doesn't have to be that way, right? It's all rules they can rewrite. Like, if you want to have, you could have a conditional kind of red flag where it's like, everybody stays in their cars, you can't change tires, we're just stopping for a minute, we're just pausing the race. It's like not, or something like that, right? Like, it's like, these are all just like, I get that, like, yeah, the current red flag, the way red flags currently work is probably not ideal, but like, all of that is changeable if you want it to be. It's like, you know, so it's just, to me, these are all solvable
only
problems.
Only Rolex is going to be like, there's no way you're stopping early. We're getting all of our time here.
Yeah, totally.
So yeah, that was a bummer, but it honestly didn't matter because nobody was going to be catching Verstappen unless they get a restart, right? That's the one chance I think Leclerc had of actually being able to beat
Max. If you get a standing restart and Max blows the start, which he hasn't really done this year, but he has historically actually not been the best off the starting line. It's actually probably been – this year he's been perfectly fine. He's been great. But historically it's probably been the one chink in his armor or one of the – you know, and that – you know, yeah, maybe it gives Leclerc a chance. But, I mean, we're talking – a pretty slim odds here.
We're talking pretty slim odds here.
This is some real fantasy land for Ferrari fans here, I think.
What did you make of Leclerc's race in general? He started on pole, like we said. He finished P2. They got to plan C at the very
they
least.
They got to plan
with,
C.
with regards to the pit strategy. Is there anything they could have done to win this race?
No, I really don't think so. I saw a bunch of people on Twitter like giving Ferrari the business, you know, for yet another week on like, what was this strategy? What were they thinking with the two pit stops? To me, it's like, I'm glad they tried something. You know what? I'm happy they were decisive. Instead of sitting around debating things ad nauseum and letting opportunities pass them by, a window for a cheap stop came up. They took it. That gained them probably 7 to 10 seconds of track time. Which
they were maybe the only team that even got into the pits.
I think they were. And they desperately needed those 7 to 10 seconds if they were going to be anywhere, any sort of competitive. You know, I get, you know, it's, at the end of the day, when you look after his second stop, when he goes into second place and he comes back out on fresh softs, and at that point, Max is on mediums, what, you know, 10 lap old mediums or something in that range. You know, he's not eating into his time at all.
It took a while.
It took him 10 laps to take off a second. He needed to be gaining a second a lap. So at the end of the day, and he was on much fresher tires, faster tires and fresher tires. That is the sort of pace gap that could not have been overcome on track. You know, it's just, there was nothing they could have done.
That last stint when Leclerc is on the fastest tires and Verstappen is on worst tires that were used and it wasn't making a difference, then you're like, oh, what are you supposed to do? They tried everything they could.
Literally the only thing they could have done, this is also easy to say in 2020 hindsight, I think maybe you run a slightly higher downforce car that's meant to run longer, more effectively. Although that's easy said than done. The reason Red Bull's able to run their high downforce package at Monza is because they have so much engine power, they don't worry about the increased drag on the straights because they're still getting such pace. Everybody else probably can't take that. So, from a car setup standpoint, I don't know, they had a lot of options. I guess if you look back, you would say the optimal strategy was to run long in your first stint, to go long on the mediums. It seems like those were the people who did long first stints, like Hamilton, like Carlos, were seemingly making it around faster in aggregate. That's 2020 hindsight. It's easy to say.
And it's easier to start your guy further back on the grid and expect for him to go long.
Well, and there's good strategic reasons to do that in terms of like taking advantage of overtaking people when they pit and things like that, other cars, as opposed to if you start Leclerc on mediums, you know, you risk him losing first out the gates, you know, maybe with another guy next to him who's on softs or something, you know, him getting overtaken before the first corner. It's at the end of the day, these are all rock and hard place decisions. There's no magic strategy that made them faster than Red Bull on Sunday. There just isn't. There isn't a combination here.
I do agree with you. Ferrari did not blow it strategy-wise, but we do got a good question here from Greg Hay, who was nice enough to send it in on Twitter for the engagement. He could have just asked us in the group chat.
Yeah, we are in the group chat. Yeah. But thanks, Greg.
But he said on Twitter.com, why are Ferrari drivers managing their own tire strategies? I suppose that's a question because you heard a lot of times
them
calling to Leclerc and him and saying, hey, which of these would you like to go to?
This is a great question.
It seems weird.
Okay. There's different answers to this. Mattia Binotto's answer would be, our strategists are driving strategy, but what the driver wants to do and how the driver is feeling is an input.
Yeah.
So it's important to get that input and understand how they feel about our strategy at any given moment. And our options. I think a more cynical take might be strategy has been a hot mess and the drivers have been really upset about strategy, and a way to manage their being frustrated with the team in the pit wall is to make them the decision makers.
Sure.
You know, like, and to say, well, you can't be that mad. You approved of the call we made. you know, that to me, which I think kind of maybe both can be true. There's a little bit like, I think it's somewhere probably in the middle, but I think they're both hedging in terms of PR and driver management and all these things, while also just trying to get a sense of how the driver's feeling on different tire options and what they think they can do.
Yeah, it did to me seem to be a little bit of a going out of their way to get Leclerc's input, you know, to make it seem like they weren't just burying him with ridiculous strategy calls. My last question with regards to Ferrari is, did you like the yellow fin that they had on the car?
I thought it was fine. I actually, we talked about this last week. Yeah. I was into the yellow suits.
Very cool.
I thought the fin was okay.
It was okay. They could have gone, definitely could have gone more yellow.
They, I feel like Ferrari actually, for such an iconic car, for such an iconic look, can be a little bit clunky with its livery design. Mm-hmm. Like, a lot of things are just, like, slapped on there. Like, the logos of the sponsors, in my opinion, aren't that well integrated. They're just kind of, like, big and on the side. And, like, I thought the fin was a little just, like, slapped on there. I feel like it could all be a little bit more artful than it is.
Yeah, and I hadn't really noticed it until we saw it during the race, but the Shell logo and the Ferrari yellow, they're different yellows.
Yeah, they are different
yellows.
They're not a perfect match.
And
you
there.
Notice that really when you see the their race suits live.
You could see
the difference there for sure.
All right, I guess I maybe have a few more Ferrari questions because Carlos Sainz and Lewis Hamilton both had really great recovery drives. Like I said, Sainz started P18, finished P4, Hamilton P19. He finished P5, had a really cool double overtake of Gasly and Norris. I think that was about halfway through. Maybe I don't have a question.
They just drove great.
This is cool. It's cool when fast cars start at the back and have to pass a lot of people.
Yeah, and they also drove great. I mean, I think we've seen instances this year where, you know, people maybe underachieve in terms of back of the grid, you know, making their way up opportunities. You know, they don't get as high. I think both of them probably maximized what they could have done here. I think that's, for all intents and purposes, the best realistic spot they could have ended without one of the top three runners having
an issue.
Yeah, you know, like so it's like, so well done, job well done. You like drove the pants off the car and finished with as much points as I think was plausible, which is about the best you could ask of them.
Right? Yeah, definitely. I saw that Hamilton said afterwards, 1,000 times more fun driving in the mid-pack, which is kind of hilarious because just last week he got into beef with Fernando Alonso saying this guy can't pass anyone. So I think Hamilton went out of his way to make a point on Sunday. The other big story, though, from the Monza GP, former Formula E, Formula 2 champion Nick DeVries made his debut for the Williams Racing Team and brought home points, finishing 9th. What a crazy weekend for this guy. FP1, practice, the first practice on Friday, he was driving for Aston Martin.
Yeah.
By FP3, he was there for Williams. He advanced to Q2, like we said, finished P13. I think he ended up starting 8th, however, in the race.
Right.
Was running in 10th for quite some time, had a lot of battles with Zhou Guan Yu, and then ultimately finished 9th after Daniel Ricciardo retired. He did get dinged a little bit for erratic driving, which I was happy to see he didn't get a penalty.
Yeah.
I thought that the stewards were probably just like, hey, man, you're going a little crazy out there, but we'd love to see it because you're up here.
Yeah, I think that would have been like, well, it would have been pretty late to take his points away.
That's a real dickhead boost.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, nobody wants that. No, that was awesome. I mean, that's so cool. I think he's such a talent. I think he definitely showed that he deserves a drive next year. You know, that
why
did
it take so long for him to get a shot?
I don't know, man. I mean, this is a great question. There's a lot of really talented guys sitting out there hovering just on the edge. You know, there's not that many seats. And, you know, I think you've just seen, I mean, the simple answer is there's only 20 drives.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like there's only 20 guys can do this. There's always going to be somebody on the outside looking in of a situation like that, especially when you see, you have a generation of mega talented young guys who immediately preceded Nick. You know, the Verstappens, the Leclercs, the Norrises, the Russells, who filled a lot of seats.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because those four guys alone are all championship caliber guys. And then at the same time, you've got a few guys who are really old and are hanging around. The Hamiltons, the Alonzos, the Vettels, and before this year, the Raikkonens, filling up seats as well, not retiring. So I think it's like there's, you know, on both ends of it, guys like Nick are getting a little squeezed for a race seat. But hopefully he gets one next year now. Certainly, if I was a young team, if I was a Williams, you know, if I'm, I don't know who else, you know, Haas or somebody. I mean, it doesn't look like Haas is talking to him, but somebody needs to be giving him a call. Because this is an impressive drive.
Oh,
it's
definitely
not easy.
He's been linked to driving for Williams next year and then Alpine, I guess, as well.
Yep.
Depending on how things end up going with Gasly. Is he like a prospect on the level of a Leclerc or a Piastri? I mean, he's got championships in his past, but people don't talk about Nick DeVries as a future F1 champion the way they do a Leclerc or even like a Norris, I feel like, had probably a higher pedigree.
You know, I think he, in the right car, could be super competitive. You know, I think he's in that, like, second top tier of guys. You know, I don't think of him as quite like a Russell, Leclerc, Verstappen type. But, I mean, he definitely could prove me wrong. I mean, definitely could prove me wrong. And let's be real, he went into Formula E and looked great. And Formula E is very competitive. Lots of super talented guys there. And a series that really emphasizes driver talent. There's not as much variance in the cars as you see in Formula One. So, you know, for him to go and perform as well as he did in that series, it's, you know, he is super talented. I'll tell you right now, absolutely, you know, good enough to deserve a shot in the big time, you know. For sure.
You think he's going to be taking Latifi's spot at the very least? I mean,
my God, what a catastrophe weekend for Latifi to have a guy who's never, like a guy who's never even driven in a race before, come out and score points in the Williams while you're just drifting in the back. Latifi is at the, I mean, he's not even 20th in the series. He's 21st.
Yeah.
I think he's technically behind Nico Hülkenberg, I think because of like their average finishing position or something like that, right? I don't know, like something like that. He's having a bad year. I'm sorry, Nick.
He's having a bad year.
I'm sorry, Nicholas. I'm not sure that.
Yeah, 2 points for DeVries, zero for Latifi. And Latifi's been in many, many more races. But the only reason DeVries got even a shot in the Williams seat is because of the complications Alex Albon had. Apparently, he had to have laparoscopic surgery to remove his appendix after suffering a bout of appendicitis. It got worse because of unexpected post-operative anesthetic complications. Which led to respiratory failure, which is a known but uncommon complication. Albon was reintubated after the complications, transferred to ICU for support. He's now off a ventilator and out of ICU. I think he was supposed to be going home today or yesterday. I haven't seen anything on socials about that yet. But he wants to be back for the Singapore GP, which seems pretty quick to me.
Yeah, he's got a couple of weeks now, right? We've got a break before the next race, so maybe that gives him a shot. That is super scary what happened. I'm glad that he seems like he's doing okay now, but gosh, what a wild weekend, you know? I mean, I think as you know, Thursday of last week or something like that, he probably thought he was driving in a Formula One Grand Prix, you know? So it's like, so definitely a crazy weekend. Glad he's doing as well as can be expected.
Yeah, it seems like they got things handled, and hopefully we'll see some stuff coming through and not too long of him actually being home and getting ready to race again. I did see that Netflix cameras were in and about Monza, which means we should get the entire story of DeVries' debut at some point during Drive to Survive. So that's about it from like the major stuff that happened in the race. Let's move on to surprises and disappointments. Anything else you want to mention?
I mean, okay, so disappointments, I'm going to go ahead and call out Aston Martin for, I think, yet another really subpar weekend. I think this is looking pretty bad. That's certainly not a surprise. It's not a bad, you know, at this point for them to underperform, but I thought this was an especially ugly Grand Prix from them. You know,
both of their cars DNF'd for the race, and both were not competitive at all in qualifying.
No, they were not. Yeah, it's like they were finishing with 0 points either way, whether they finished in the garage or on the track,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
So it's like but it was a shame to see Vettel DNF in his final Italian Grand Prix. I think that probably is a bummer. You know, every one of these, that's the thing I think I hate about it, is every one of these like subpar Aston Martin weekends means that like Vettel's last trip around any given track is like a one to forget.
Yeah, it's like it's a win if he finishes.
Totally. That's a bummer. That's a bummer. It's a bummer for a guy who's like a, you know, a legend of the sport. So, wish that was differently. Not surprises. I mean, we already talked about what for me is the number one surprise, which is Nick DeVries finishing in the points.
Yeah,
you know, so that that I of course wanted it, was rooting for it. Didn't actually think he would pull that off. It's very hard. Very hard.
Totally.
You know, like, I was just like, I think this is going to be tough to, for him to hold on to that.
Yeah, who knows how it would have actually transpired if Ricardo doesn't retire, because it was getting close between Zhou and Nick DeVries to actually finish 10th. But then once Ricardo retired, they both moved up a slot.
Yep.
Ended up getting points. Worked out nice for Zhou. His first points since Canada. George Russell, I'll give him a little nod. He said he finished P3. Like, this guy's having an incredible season for Mercedes, but because they are third in the championship and because Hamilton is struggling compared to his success throughout his career, it's definitely going underneath the radar, I think, how good Russell's been.
He's been incredible.
How's this for a surprise and a disappointment? McLaren. I think they get both, because Daniel Ricciardo made it to Q3. That was awesome. Due to penalties, he started P4. He was on track for his first points since France. And then he had the DNF that kind of ended the race. As for Lando Norris, he started P3, ended P7. He's the best of the rest guy out there right now. It's basically between him and Alonso. And the McLaren was better this weekend. So a good weekend for them, but it could have been better. They were on track for a double points finish.
It probably didn't. I love that one because, first of all, this is a weekend where I think Alpine underperformed a little bit.
Agree.
And you thought McLaren should have struck back points-wise, and then they really didn't capitalize on that. So that's a bummer for them. I think that, and you're right, Norris is, while he is best of the rest, it is like a mixed bag there because he had an awful start.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he totally blew the start and potentially missed out on an opportunity to finish higher. I get, it's not easy to see. There's a world where even with a good start, the Mercedes and the Ferraris and the Red Bulls, you know, Perez, Hamilton, and Sainz all overtake him. But, you know, he probably would have been a little bit more defensible. So it's, I don't know. Yeah, you're right. I'm very mixed bag for McLaren.
Mixed bag for McLaren, but a full bag of beans coming up right here. Oh, yeah, we got to hand out our full beans driver of the weekend award. It goes to the driver who really gave it their all out there on the track. In Monza. Graydon, who you got?
Okay. I mean, we've already talked about him a lot, but I think it's only appropriate. I'm giving it to Nick DeVries.
You got to.
Yeah, I mean, you got to. That's awesome. I mean, it's. I just can't say enough good things about going out there on short notice with no prep, you know, minimal time spent in an F1 car. And getting in the points. That's awesome, man. So, well-deserved. A great drive.
Yeah, DeVries has got to be the guy. We don't even know the next time we'll see him on the grid. So, to actually take home a couple of points is really cool. So, no doubt, our full beans driver of the weekend, Nick DeVries. I think that's it from Monza. We're going to take a quick break here. When we get back, Graydon's going to explain something.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day, or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service that you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Back with the Breaky Boys. We got a new segment here we've been wanting to try. Graydon's going to explain something that happens in Formula One. We put the call out on Twitter and y'all answered. This one comes to us from Kevin, who says, Graydon, explain adjustments to rear wings race to race in relation to drag or necessary downforce.
Yeah, great question. And a really critical part of the decision making that a team has to make going into every race. So just we actually have a graphic to help explain this, but before you bring that, well, whatever. Now it's up. It's okay. Whatever. Right. Okay. Well, okay. So basically,
you can tell this guy's a Ferrari fan. Can't make up his mind.
Yeah. Long story short, you know, a more aggressively shaped wing like the one at Hungary on the bottom, as you could see here, is going to be generating more downforce. It's going to be helping the car kind of gain pace in corners, both fast and slow. But it's going to add more drag on straight, which is why you see very low downforce setups in places like Monza or Belgium, where it's better to have the lower amounts of drag so you can have pace on the straights. This graphic comes from our friends at the race, and is really instructional here because you actually see kind of like the full spectrum. Hungary is a very high corner track where there's lots of corners, very kind of comparatively minimal, you know, full speed sections. So you're running a high downforce package there to give you more speed in the corners. This is historically, through earlier in the season at least, what Ferrari seemed to excel at when they could run a really high downforce package in places like a Monaco or other spots, you know, seemingly very strong. Oppositely, Belgium is a place where you would see it's very much a course that engine power is king. There's long, big straights like the Kemmel Straight that you want lower drag. So you can see here they have a wing that's going to be causing much less resistance there. And then the Dutch Grand Prix, which you see is kind of a hybrid of the two, right? So the Dutch Grand Prix is like kind of in the middle in terms of the amount of downforce that you want. It's a little bit more of a balanced package. And you can literally see in this instance from the Alpine, I believe, that they have like literally taken a piece of the Belgian wing and a piece of the Hungary wing and kind of like combined them together, hopefully to like try to find that balance. This is also really interesting because you used to see way more variance race to race with the wings in the back. But now people, because of budgetary constraints, are trying to like salvage components more and are trying to like cobble together, you know, more extreme and more balanced, low downforce, high downforce, somewhere in the middle packages. This past weekend in Monza, you saw what are probably the smallest rear wings of the season. You noticed that they were very slim. And when you saw the DRS open, you could see, you know, it kind of very barely opened because they were so narrow. And they mentioned that, how because the DRS was, the wing was so small and there was already such minimal drag, it gave, the DRS actually wasn't that powerful. It was only good for about, like, I think they said something like 6 kilometers an hour
right
down the straights. Oftentimes it can be, it can add way more speed than that. So that's kind of the main thing there is that, you know, you're going to be how many slow corners are there? How much, you know, how many straights are there? How much time are you at full speed? Are you at in high gear on a course? You know, these are the sort of considerations you'll make when you run either a high or low downforce package. And the wing plays a big part of that.
I'm glad you mentioned the DRS flap because that was going to be my main question is how does that play into the rear wing? Because obviously when you can access DRS, you open the flap, you can see it happen on the car when they're out there on the track. But does it have to be like a regulated opening? Like it feels to me every car should only be able to open the same amount.
It is actually a regulated opening. This is something that Lewis Hamilton got in trouble with last year, I believe, at the Brazilian Grand Prix, wasn't it? Where they were measuring it.
Oh, your
they
hole's had too
said,
big.
Yeah, and they had said that maybe there was a gap there or something there. So yeah, there is it is regulated how much it can open. But it is also, you know, something where people don't really worry about. The DRS is almost always activated on a straight. Mm-hmm. So in that instance, you want to get rid of the downforce you're generating anyways. You want, because it's creating drag, right? So it's fine in those instances. That's why, you know, teams are happy to do it. But that is a regulated component of the car as well. So
hey, Graydon, thanks for explaining that.
No problem.
You're a great wingman.
Hopefully that helps. Hopefully next time you're enjoying the Singapore Grand Prix, you think, Oh, gosh. Wow.
Look at those wings.
Look at those.
My friend Graydon told me all about those. But we want to hear some more things you need explained. So let us know on Twitter, down in the comments, send us an email, and let us know what you want Graydon to explain. We got a little bit of a backlog of them, but we could always use more. That's a new segment. This is an old segment. Is this news? Oh, is this news, Graydon? I don't know that I've seen the new graphic with a bunch of creep faces in the background from your boys here in the Classic Factory. How this works, I'll give you a recent headline in the Formula One world, and you'll tell me whether or not it's actually newsworthy. This one comes from Race Fans. Reverse grid sprint races are under consideration again. Graydon, is this news?
Yeah, I think it's news. I mean, it's coming from Stefano Domenicali, the CEO of F1, so seemingly if he's interested, it's something they're seriously considering, and it would be a huge change to the sprint race weekends.
Yeah, Domenicali said each session should be giving away either points or single qualifying laps or a qualification for a different and shorter Saturday race instead of the third free practice, perhaps with the mechanism of the inverted grid, basically saying too much practicing. Let's get racing out there, boys.
The other part of that is him saying, he was saying how free practices should have points at stakes as well, which I actually don't know if I agree with that.
I think that makes it not a practice.
Yeah, it seems, yeah. I don't know what they would be awarding points for. I'm presuming fastest lap during the free practice.
Sure.
But I presume, but that struck me as an odd one and unnecessary. It's okay if, like, there aren't points at stake in five different sessions over the course of the weekend. That's perfectly fine. Like,
he's trying to make it so you have to watch every single lap, every single second they're out there.
No Breaks will be like 4 hours long. We'll have to talk about every single little piece of every weekend.
Well, then I hope they don't do this because we only have 11 minutes until the saws start again. I know you're anti-inverted grid, but having like Verstappen start in the back, Hamilton, Sainz, we've seen it basically for the entirety of the triple header. It's almost been an inverted grid, and guess what? It's been really cool.
My worry about it and the thing I'd want to hear an explanation on is how are they going to not create perverse incentives during the qualifying session where people aren't trying to go their fastest in qualifying. I guess what that means is you'd have to award a lot more points probably for finishing first, second, third, in actual qualifying.
There's
got to be
a
lot more points at stake because it would seem to me that you would sandbag on that Friday to be more competitive on Saturday.
Love sandbagging. I love it. That's one of my favorite F1 terms and just one of my favorite things to do in general. Our next headline comes from Twitter from Aston Martin. So, pretty solid source. Felipe Drugovich will become the first member of the Aston Martin Driver Development Program. Is this news?
It's close to news. Yeah, it's close newsy. To news. It's newsy.
Like, is it news when somebody joins a driver academy?
I mean, it's new for a certain level of F1 sicko. News. I don't know that it's headline news.
What do you know about Drugovich?
I know that he had a really dominant F2 season. Has already wrapped up the F2 title. I think he just really crushed it, and so seemingly looks like a real talent. Another guy who probably deserves a shot. Again, it's just a really crowded grid, and I don't know if there's a seat for him.
Well, just looking at Aston Martin, we know they've got Alonso coming in next year. Surely that's a high value deal, and he's an established driver. The other driver is the owner's son,
so
he's probably not going anywhere. Is Drugovich good? Like, is he good enough to knock either of those guys out of the way? I mean, Stroll is locked in. I
gotta think that you wanna already start planning to backfill Alonso at some point. I mean, he can only be there so many more years. I get he would race till he's like 70, but at some point they'll want a younger guy in there. I don't know how long. For me, the big X factor is Stroll, who like generally underperforms, but not Latifi level bad.
Right.
Like he does get in the points. He has days. He beats his teammate. Like it's not an embarrassment that Stroll is out there on the track. Like, it's not, as much as I liked to give him crap when he first joined.
Yeah.
So I think the question is like, how long does he hold on if there's a better option, and how much better does that option need to be for them to also potentially replace him, maybe the answer is there is no such thing.
Sure.
They're not going to get rid of – he's going to keep that seat until he wants to get rid of it. You know, but I don't know. I also think the other thing that's interesting here is just Aston Martin's evolution as a team. You know, they've been investing in facilities. They've been investing, you know, now in a driver development program. These are the sort of things that the big guys do, the Mercedes, right, the Ferraris, the Red Bulls. So they're trying to act – even as the cars slide farther and farther towards the back of the grid, they're trying to act like a major team, not like a customer team, which is interesting.
Fake it till you make it. I love it. I think it's smart. I was surprised to see that Drugovich is going to become their first driver in their driver academy, because I just would have assumed with all that we hear about reserve drivers and, you know, rookies getting a shot during a free practice and all we've heard about Herta and Piastri and all these younger drivers, I would have just assumed every team has a driver academy. It seems like you should.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely not everybody does. Not everybody makes that investment. I mean, a lot of it just costs a lot of money, I think, to manage and support these guys. And oftentimes, you're paying part of their way in the lower series, you know, or when you go to other places, like, you know, for example, Schumacher at Haas. You know, Ferrari's covering part of his salary,
right,
as a member of their. So you're committing to do that sort of stuff, you know, and that is. It's just expensive. It's just expensive, right? So different folks just aren't in a position to do that. But I think Aston Martin, I guess theoretically is. I don't think capital is their challenge right now. I don't think it's like they don't have enough money to compete. It's not easy to like shoot to the front. You can't just, you know, throw money at this problem. It takes time to build up a great team.
Well, I hope he makes it to the grid eventually, because I can hear the name Felipe Drugovich showing up in an Action Bronson song very easily. Mm. Our next headline comes from Talk Sport. Keanu Reeves reveals Formula One documentary about Jenson Button's title win in 2009. This is media news. This is Hollywood news. The question I have for you is, what's so interesting about Jenson Button's title win in 2009?
Oh, this is like my – well, it's great. It's like literally my favorite championship of the last like 20 years. It's great. It's the
driving
Braun
for Braun GP in 2009. Give us a little bit of a background.
So going into in 2008, Braun GP doesn't even exist. Ross Braun, who is now technical director for the FIA or for Formula One, had been Michael Schumacher's, you know, kind of lead guy at Benetton, and then his lead guy at Ferrari. He is the kind of technical mastermind behind the Ferrari cars that dominated the early 2000s. And then he had gone over to Honda GP, which in the wake of the great financial crisis and the global economic issues, Honda had decided to pull out of Formula One and was going to be shutting down the team. And Braun was like, but we have an incredible car. And Braun swept in and bought the team from Honda, and for 1 year operated the team as Braun GP on a razor thin budget. He basically had pennies, not dollars, left over when they had bought the team. But they did. They had an incredible car. They weren't able to develop the car at all over the season, really. They didn't have any money, but they just were so good to begin with, so much further ahead, that they dominated the early half of the season and managed to hold out to win the title. And Jenson Button, who nobody had picked going into that season, them or Jenson Button, to be the world champion, like, managed to pull it out. It's like, very, very few Cinderella stories in F1, right? Very, because it's the same cast of dominant characters over and over. This is like their underdog Cinderella story of the last, you know, 20 so years, and super awesome. I'm really glad they're making a doc about this. I hope it's good, because the story merits like a good telling.
Sounds like a story that needs to be told. My question to you also would be, what's Jenson Button like as a personality? We hear him on the broadcast sometimes. He seems a
chill,
little staid.
He seems nice. Yeah, I think he's a little bit like nice, mellow. He's not like a character.
Yeah.
He's very like inside the lines. I think he's just like loving life as a Formula One world champion, as a guy who probably should have never been a Formula. Like,
nice,
he is the one, he is the edge case. Like, he is the guy where it's like nobody really had pegged him to win a title. not just that year, but in, I mean, I'm not trying to dog Jensen here. He was a good driver for sure.
Surprise,
he was definitely
title.
A good driver, but it's a bit of a surprise that he won. And there's a reason he only won one, you know, and it came in this insane technical aberration inside this one car.
Would it be an insult to call him the Trent Dilfer of Formula One?
Wow. I mean,
Trent Dilfer got a Super Bowl, but it was with the Ravens and their great defense.
Yeah. I mean, it's a little harsh.
It's a little harsh. Button is better than Trent Dilfer.
A little harsh.
Glad to hear it. Yeah.
A little harsh. Yeah. So, no, I'm
okay.
I'm
Joe Flacco then.
Yeah, sure. Well, Joe Flacco's, I mean, a fairly elite. Yeah. At least he was.
fairly. Yeah. My only other question is, did they call the car a Bronda at the time?
Oh, Bron GP? God,
they bought it from Honda? Come on.
I don't know.
That could be the title of the
documentary. You know, so fun fact, that I believe they're still in the same facilities, I believe, and the Bron GP was... That is what Mercedes bought. It is the lineage of the Mercedes team is the Honda and then Braun GP team. I believe they were based out of Brackley, like Toto and the Mercedes boys are. So that's the heritage of that team.
I will be watching the documentary. Hope they get into all of that. But finally, we got to the best part of the show. That's our last Is This News headline. It comes from the Daily Express. The headline literally reads, Sylvester Stallone, 76, looks ageless in cheeky closed fist pose with Verstappen. And there's a picture of Sly Stallone himself.
Look at ageless.
He showed up at the Monza GP this weekend. I don't know if it's true, but Reddit said that this is the first time that Sly has been to a Formula One race since 1998 when he did the exact same pose with Michael Schumacher. Look at him. Ah, look at ageless in both of these photos. Looks the exact same in 1998 and in 2022.
Yeah.
Graydon, is this news?
This is absolutely news.
I think
this is big news. The fact that Sly Stallone basically... 40 years ago, they chiseled him into stone, and he hasn't aged a day.
Not a day.
Over that time is incredible and is absolutely something we should be celebrating and talking about.
It looks the exact same.
He looks exactly the same.
Same pose, though.
There's nothing different about him whatsoever. Same pose.
It is awesome.
I guess it's a Rocky thing.
I love it.
Is doing like the boxer's closed fist thing.
Yeah, he does the boxer's closed fist in every photo.
Yeah, in, like,
as if he were
photo.
A real boxer.
Yeah, it totally. That's the thing.
He wasn't
actual
really
boxers
Rocky Balboa.
Do not actors who played a boxer in a movie one time.
That is ageless though.
He's like, in a lot of Rocky movies.
They made five Rockies. Then they made Rocky Balboa, and then I think they've made.
Two
Creeds?
Does that sound right?
I think that's about
JD.
Right. Did they make three Creeds, or was the third Creed or the second Creed the Drago son one?
They definitely made. Why am I there? Oh,
I like
my
it.
God! Here, I'll just go to my chat. They made two Creeds.
Two Creeds. The second one was the Drago Creed.
I haven't seen it.
Yeah,
actually,
me neither.
But I assume
I saw the
so.
First one. I didn't see the second one.
Yeah. First one was amazing.
Yeah, first one was really good.
Well, Coogler,
yeah, the first
right?
one was
Ryan
really
Coogler,
good. And in
right?
general,
yeah.
Ryan Coogler, really good.
Michael B. Jordan.
In general,
yes.
I like the Rocky series. One of my like fondest childhood memories, I think, which is the Drago one. It's
Rocky
IV, right?
Yeah.
So Rocky IV, I grew up in Austin, Texas. There was like a snowstorm, which shuts down Austin, Texas. Austin is ill-equipped to deal with snowstorms.
Yeah.
So my dad's from the Northeast, so he was like, whatever, like we can go out. So me and him drove to the theater and watched Rocky IV in the theater alone. In the theater, we were the only people there. And we were like up in the aisles, like boxing and things like that. No, we were literally alone in the theater watching Rocky IV. It was a cherished childhood memory of mine.
Nice.
So,
do you think we're going to be seeing a Driven 2?
For sure. 1998,
Sly shows up in the paddock. 2001, Driven drops.
3 years
2025,
later.
2025, are we looking at Driven 2?
Finally got the rights to... I think he's got to be there doing film research. I think he's got to be looking at trying to finally get to the inside of this sport, the secret sauce that he can tell a story around.
I think Joe Tonto returns to Formula One. You didn't even know he had left. Do you think Max Verstappen knows who Sly Stallone is?
Yeah, I think Sly Stallone is one of those guys who... Gen Zers, which I guess Verstappen is, right, knows. Like, Rocky is really famous, right?
Is he?
JD, do your kids know what Rocky is?
Of course.
That's also not a good barometer. What your kids know and what Max Verstappen know are totally. That Venn diagram might be two circles that aren't touching each other in terms of like media and culture.
I forced my kids to watch Rocky, the original. I made them sit through it.
Okay.
And they loved it.
And I imagine Verstappen's dad was a driver as well, right? So he was a professional athlete. He would have been of the Rocky generation. He could have shown it to his son to get him like fired up. Here's what competition's all about.
Yeah, I bet you. I feel like in general, like athletes probably are like watching Rocky. There's like gotta be like watching sports movies. Still, I don't know. Definitely, like, I would love to see a game which is just, like, basic second half of the 20th century trivia with, like, Formula One drivers. Like, what are things they do and don't know? Like, how many of the Beatles can they name? Or, like, have they, or, like, what, you know, like, you know, who played Rocky Balboa? Like, can they answer that question? I assure you they're not going to bat 1,000. Like, some of them are going
to
miss it.
Maybe we'll have to put together a card game like Cards Against Humanity, where it's just got, like, random trivia questions we can ask these guys.
Cards Against Gen Z.
Well, let us know down in the comments. Do you think Max Verstappen knows who Sylvester Stallone is? And has he seen any of the 7 to 9 Rocky movies?
That photo is 100 times funnier if he has no idea. If he has no idea who this old guy is, making this fist is much, much funnier if he doesn't know who this
guy is. I met a boxer today. Who? Sylvester Stallone? Yeah. He acted like a boxer 50 years ago. Timeless guy. But that's it for Is This News.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
Up next, we've got the Singapore GP. We came back from the summer break with the triple header, but we got to wait a little before we actually get to go to Singapore. The race is September 30th is Friday. That's practice, followed by qualies October 1st. October 2nd is the Sunday. That's the race. Let's take a quick look at the drivers and constructors standings. Max Verstappen, huge lead in the driver standings over Charles Leclerc, who is now back to second place. He leads Sergio Perez by just 9 points for P2, Perez in P3. Russell in P4, just 16 points behind Leclerc in second. Russell is followed by Sainz, who's followed by Hamilton, Norris, Ocon, Alonso, and Bottas. As for the team standings, Red Bull way out ahead with 545 points to Ferrari's 406 in P2. They're followed by Mercedes, Alpine, McLaren, Alfa Romeo, Haas, AlphaTauri, Aston Martin, and Williams. They had 4 points before Nyck de Vries took the seat. 6 points now, but still in 10th place. Graydon, haven't raced in Singapore since 2019. Do you remember the last podium in Singapore?
Yeah, it was Sebastian Vettel 1, right?
Yeah, man.
Charles Leclerc 2, and Was it Hamilton 3?
Yeah, I'll give you a hint. This guy's a huge Sly Stallone fan.
Oh, it was Verstappen.
Yeah, Max Verstappen finished 3. I'm impressed, though.
I just remember that was like kind of it was a little bit of a controversial race at the time because Charles put it on pole. Mm. And then because of their pit strategy, he got overtaken via the pit strategy by Vettel and was like furious about that, which leads me to my little preview of the Singapore Grand Prix. This is the most important qualifying of the season outside of Monaco, I would say. It is very hard to overtake at Singapore. It is a street track. It's a very physically punishing track, even at night. It's hot. It's humid. Guys come out. They look like they jumped in a pool. But it is very hard to overtake on track, and track position is absolutely king here, which is what Charles learned the hard way back in 2019. And that is why I think this is far and away of the rest of the races of the year, Ferrari's best chance to get one more win.
Sure.
Because if Charles can hook it up on Saturday, or either of them can, Carlos has actually been looking increasingly strong in qualifying as well. If they can put it on pole, that is a meaningfully huge advantage, and one that perhaps even Red Bull's outsized pace advantage, it won't make a difference in a track where it is so difficult to overtake. So I think that this is their best chance, but at the same time, it does look like if they set up the car right, I mean, Red Bull has got to be the favorite in every race going forward. So
definitely, but like you're saying, Ferrari's been pretty solid in qualifying, and if being on pole is a huge deal in Singapore, that could be a way that they actually take home a race win, which would be very important if they're going to actually finish in second place with Leclerc, because I think that that's the real race right now. Verstappen's got this thing sewed up for the championship, but we've got six races remaining to figure out who finishes in P2. Like I said, 16 points separates Leclerc in second and Russell in P4. With six races remaining, do you think Leclerc's going to hang on to P2, or do you think he'll get passed by a Red Bull or a Mercedes?
I think he's going to hang on to it, because I actually think he has absolutely been the second best driver this year, and with a little bit of pressure off, actually, like the title no longer being in question. I think you saw this you've seen this in his back-to-back podiums for the first time in a while. I think actually the lack of pressure is helping them a little bit. It makes the decisions a little bit easier. They can just focus on clean races. They can just, you know, go out there and try to get wins. I think it's actually, it's deflating for him, but I think it's a little bit healthy as far as their quality of their decision making on race day. So.
And a win would go a long way to securing that P2, so we shall see. The boys have returned with the saws from their break, but we're going to be taking a small break. No show next week because we got no race next week. We will be back the week of September 26th with something, as yet undecided. And then we're back to recap the Singapore race on the week of October 3rd, I guess the 4th would be that Tuesday. I don't know if we'll do Tuesday or Wednesday at this point, but that is the schedule for no breaks around here. Let's plug some things. Most importantly, Graydon's Twitter account, at Mr. Gordian. You really stepped your game up recently.
I mean, you challenged me, and I wanted to rise to the challenge.
I was following along with your tweets during the U.S. Open final.
Oh, it was
fun. Of course, Alcaraz, man.
Ooh,
this guy is good. Monster. You think he's the next great?
Yeah, I think he will be one of the dominant.
He's only like 19, right?
Yeah, he's the youngest, I think, number one player in the world of all time. I think he's the fastest to number one in the history of men's tennis.
I love it. Great stuff. So follow Graydon for takes on every sport. You got takes on a lot of sports. You don't know baseball takes. Not many baseball takes.
No, I'm not good with baseball.
That's all right. You got everything else. Follow at No Dunks Inc. for takes on many sports as well. You can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, and most certainly YouTube. That would be a great place to check out Is This Good, the podcast we released yesterday. Me, Skeets, JD, and Matty O. If you want to see some sweaty pits, this is the show for you.
The things are lasagna, travel, and YouTube are the three things we debated.
Yes, those were the three topics. Lasagna, is it good?
Is it good? I mean,
oh, you're out on lasagna?
I don't love lasagna as much as the average guy.
Probably don't love it as much as Garfield.
No, I mean, yeah.
Number
fair.
One lasagna lover fair. Is Garfield. Another fair. Good thing you can check out on the No Dunks YouTube channel is No Bunts. Tass was talking about these big old bases on today's show. Also talked about the Phillies for quite some time. What do you think of those bases? Too big?
Yeah, I mean, it's a big base. It's a big base. Did you talk about the shift thing? Did you debate?
Oh, a lot of shift talk.
A lot of shift talk.
Talking shift. I personally think they should have went the other way with the bases. Make them smaller.
tiny bases.
little tiny bases. Hard to stand on.
Yeah,
more
yeah.
outs. That's what there's not enough of at a baseball game.
Yeah,
outs.
Too much scoring.
Also, on the No Dunks YouTube channel tomorrow, 9 a.m. Eastern, a slightly early start. We got our current Hall of Fame locks show coming up. And no buffs. What? Our Survivor podcast? Yeah, it's coming back. Because Survivor Season 43 starts September 21st. That is a Wednesday. We will be back on September 22nd to recap the debut episode. That does have a different feed, both for the podcast and for the YouTube channel. So just search for No Buffs on YouTube.
I would have told you about your pit stains.
You would have told me?
I mean, I would have been hesitant, but I think in the end I would have been a good friend. I'd be like, hey, man, I think you
would have waited until after the show.
oh, like mid-show would I have said something?
Yeah,
okay, yeah, touche. I mid-show
yeah,
would be
I mean,
like,
I don't
hey,
even think you would have said it during a commercial break, which understandable. None of us have. That's the first time. We got sweaty pits every episode, man. I mean, I'm taking you behind the scenes right now, but there's sweaty pits in every single episode, and that's the first time.
Especially
you've actually
at No Buffs.
It.
It's hot. I mean, it's
you think
hot,
I'm sweating man. My pits right now?
I mean, it seemingly you would suggest you are.
Just a little, though. Just a little. That's why I wore a black shirt
I think
today.
It's a
so
lovely
can't even
temperature
tell.
In here. I think it's nice.
It's not the temperature. That's what people, yeah. That's what Matt said. He's like, oh, JD doesn't let you have the air conditioning on. We don't have it on today, but we did have it on yesterday, I think.
Yeah.
It's more of the performance anxiety, man.
Totally.
Wow.
Gotta come in here with all these takes. Gotta say the right stuff. Like, I've botched the exit quote the last 2 weeks. I'm honestly nervous to say it again.
Yeah, I was thinking about that, and I'm nervous
actually
for you.
I started sweating once we got to the plunge section.
I wasn't sweating, but now I am.
All right, let's give this a shot. Clipper Bros.
You heard it here first. Have a great time. Turn up. Love you guys. Awesome.
Thanks for joining us, and remember, be fast or be last.
Nailed it!
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.